Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Greetings. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press. Paul, let's start with you, and let's start by talking politics. The Tea Party Express joins Sarah Palin in endorsing Fairbanks attorney Joe Miller for the United States Senate. Tell us about the value of the endorsement, and where do we go from here?
Well, I'm not sure of the value of the endorsement. Sarah Palin, in the past recent primaries, her picks were kind of spotty. She picked some that were, pretty much giveaways, foregone conclusions. She picked some that weren't.
This is football and the 30-point favorites.
There we go, exactly. And then how can you go wrong? I'm not sure about hers. The Tea Party Express promises money, promises money. And this is a young guy out of Fairbanks. He's a lawyer. He touts himself as a constitutional conservative, and he needs a lot of money in this race if he hopes to close the gap. He's got a long way to go to catch up with her, I think, in the primary.
Brendan, Tea Party Express officials say they can deliver hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Miller campaign. Can they?
It appears that they can. They gave about $500,000 to Sharon Angle, the Tea Party candidate in the Republican primary in Nevada, who won and will be battling Harry Reid for his U.S. Senate seat, and they've promised to put $1 million into that race. They gave about $350,000 to Scott Brown in the Massachusetts race to replace Ted Kennedy, or to fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And they've raised about $2.3 million so far this year. $200,000 or $300,000. Last I looked, the end of March, Senator Murkowski had more than $2 million in the bank. So does a couple $100,000 matter? I kind of don't think so.
Tell us a little bit about genealogy here, or species. What's the difference between the Tea Party Express, and other iterations of the word or term Tea Party?
Well, the Tea Party itself is a movement, and it's an umbrella term. There are different organizations, Tea Party Nation, several others. The thing that stands out about Tea Party Express is they're the only major one that's actually a PAC. They file with the FEC, they give money to candidates, they endorse candidates, which many of the other Tea Party groups do not do. They're sort of interesting. They're headed up by a guy named Mark Williams, who's notorious for some anti-Muslim rhetoric that's been published all over the country in various publications. The Atlantic just did a lengthy piece on the Tea Party Express and its founder. And another notable thing is Sarah Palin charges for her speeches. We all know that. We've all heard the figures. The Tea Party Express, who she's spoken at events for twice, is the only organization that she doesn't charge for. So she's really aligned herself with them. And I think that that's why so much attention's being given to this particular race up here in Alaska.
And it's her home state.
It is. It is. And, it was picked up by the New York Times, by NPR, everyone immediately after the press release that we all got about them endorsing Joe Miller.
Paul, if you're Lisa Murkowski, how do you respond to the charge that you're not conservative enough?
I'm not even sure you respond to it. It's her conservative credentials are pretty sterling. She opposed Obama's health care. She's got an A rating from the NRA. She opposed discretionary non-defense funding. She's been pretty much on the right side of most issues. The far right of the party, I think, dates all the way back to her days in the legislature, if you will, when she supported
here
taxes.
In Alaska.
In Alaska, when she supported taxes and that kind of thing. And I think that sort of thing's carried forward. I think in a senator, you need more than just hard right rhetoric anymore to be in the Republican Party. I think she's able to work with both sides. She's demonstrated that. I think she's not going to have that much trouble, I don't think.
Brendan, what would constitute a good showing for Miller?
Well, if you look at 2004's primary race, which was against another Miller, Mark Miller, he managed to get 37% of the vote to her 58. I would be surprised if Joe Miller can pull off 37% of the vote. Dave Dittman, the Republican pollster, did a poll in April about the same month that Joe Miller announced his candidacy, And overall,
it's so, Mike Miller of Fairbanks. It took me a second.
Mike Miller, yes, yeah. The in 2004. 75% of Republicans want to see Lisa keep the seat, Senator Murkowski. 49% of Democrats wanted to see her keep the seat, according to Dittman's poll, and 62% of nonpartisans. So he didn't pull her against Joe Miller in that particular poll, but those numbers are really, really hard to argue with.
Paul, I'm wondering, will the Tea Party's entrance, Tea Party Express, excuse me, entrance into this race energize an election season that in many respects has been torpid?
God, I hope so. I mean, torpid has been boring. There's only one race worth watching, Lieutenant Governor's race with GOP. If this sparks it up, if this gets the public interested, this is a good thing. I think what will really do it is if Sarah Palin comes back into the state to campaign for the candidate she endorsed. I think at that point, then you got fireworks. Then you're going to see some interest on both sides of the aisle, and it'll pick up.
Brendan, you were going to say.
Yeah, Bob Poe mentioned something at his press conference the other day when he was dropping out, that there was gubernatorial fatigue. I think that there's electoral fatigue at this point. We had an election in April. We had an election in November. We had, you know, we've been through some intense stuff, particularly with Sarah Palin's rise in particular. In popularity, and I do think that there's a big element to fatigue, and it's taken a lot to get voters excited about any particular races right now.
And it's pretty interesting because it's at odds with the national mood.
Yes.
When you read national stories, they reflect the public's desire to participate, have their say, and in some cases make changes. Okay, late-breaking story from the Department of Health and Social Services. Department revealed the number of abortions that were paid for by Denali Kid Care number. The number is 664. Paul, give us some detail on this story.
During the budget process, Governor Parnell cut $3 million from Denali Kid Care. That money was set up to expand services of Denali Kid Care to X number of children and mothers. He said that he vetoed it because it was being used for abortions and that it had funded hundreds of abortions. Senator Betty Davis stood up immediately, no, that's not right. Just, there's probably a few, but most of it was for abortion services. Well, the numbers are out, and yes, they were used for something called abortions, listed as abortion. Mind you, there are many procedures that could be listed as an abortion that are really not abortions, and any abortions done by this outfit is supposed to be done being medically necessary, as certified by a doctor. So it could be DNCs after a miscarriage. It could be a necessary procedure for a woman who's got a condition that won't allow her to be pregnant. It could be anything. So until they tell us what that 664 really is, we don't really have a clue, except it's a big number. And we're to believe that 664 women had abortion services, and that could be prenatal care, that can be sonograms, and then went ahead and had abortions, all of them.
And it becomes a different discussion when the discussion is about the number of hundreds of thousands of dollars spent,
exactly.
And then you have a number,
that's right.
664,
that's
which
right.
Has a
for
an
1 year. That's for 1 year.
Yeah,
I think over a five-year period, it approaches 3,000.
Brendan, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the politics here? Because they clearly are important. The Democrats were trying to hang their hat on this in going after Parnell.
Well, Parnell had supported increasing the qualification level for Denali Kid Care from 175% of the federal poverty level to 200%. That's the funding he vetoed. He later vetoed the bill. Right before, so he said, I just found out that this funds abortions. That sort of proved to not necessarily be quite accurate because he was a senator when Denali Kid Care was created. The committee minutes of the time show that he asked specifically if abortion had to be included. It's federal dollars, much like Medicaid. It's a must if it's medically necessary, which is rape, incest, or the life of the mother. Outside of the politics of this, I have to sort of elaborate on what Paul said, that their own statistics, the state's statistics say there were 1,875 abortions in 2009.
In Alaska.
Are we to believe that a third of those were not only medically necessary, but for people who made less than 175% of the federal poverty level? It just doesn't ring accurate to me that a third, more than a third, would be under the federal poverty level to qualify for Denali Kid Care and also be medically necessary. So I agree with Paul. I think we really need some clarification
on this. I guess clearly you would argue that putting forth this number, 664, is not going to end the debate. It's just another step in the debate.
Yeah, it's absolutely going to further it. I think we spoke about it on a previous show, but this is primary politics. It's Parnell in a... You know, he's got some serious challengers, although he leads in the polls, and he's pandering to the pro-lifers.
Although he would say that I'm telling it like it is.
If he was really pro-life, he should move to have a special session and abolish the entire program so that we didn't have those 664.
Let's stick with you, Brendan. Meanwhile, gubernatorial candidate Bob Poe, the Democrat, drops out of the governor's race. Why?
Money. Very simply, money. He said at his press conference he had spent about $110,000 traveling around the state trying to get his name out there. Bob is a career bureaucrat. He's worked under four governors, worked extensively in the private sector, but nobody knew who he was. He's never ran for office before. He had a name recognition issue and just was brand new to politics. He did his best. He went all over the state. He had this bus and this sausage and politics tour, but he hit the breaking point. I talked to him about it, and you know, he wasn't willing to, you know, mortgage his house or just put anything more into it. He's down in the polls against Hollis French and Ethan Berkowitz. And it just became, he said he would need about another $100,000 to continue through to the primary. The poll numbers weren't showing that was going to give him any gains. And so it comes down to money and name recognition.
Do we have a hint of who he would endorse?
He's not hinting at that yet. He told me that he's going to sit down with various... candidates. He told me two Democrats and one Republican have called him. Bob is a very moderate guy. He became a Democrat the day that he filed to run for governor. So it's not surprising that a Republican may have called him and wants to sit down and talk about an endorsement as well, because he's a very pro-business and business-oriented sort of candidate.
Paul, how does the Democratic gubernatorial race shape up right now?
How does it shape up right now?
Yeah.
Well, with Poe out, you've got Berkowitz and Hollis French. The interesting thing, just for a moment, talk about Poe. When he was talking about how much money he needs, at this point, I suppose back in Palin's campaign in '06, she had $354,000, or she had amassed that much. Parnell, as of February, the last time that the APOC reports were filed, Parnell had $214,000 to spend. Mr. Poe was $9,000 in the hole at that time. So, I mean, that gives you some idea of where that campaign was going or not going. And I think Ethan Berkowitz is February, $108,000 to spend, and Hollis French, $65,000 to spend. So those two, and I think when you probably pull out the Republican, I didn't pull up the GOP money for this particular time. I bet you it's way more than that.
And plus, Palin had run statewide previously.
Right.
And,
that's right.
And
she had a little bit of name recognition, yeah. Right.
People knew. Okay, Brendan, the candidates for governor met in Wasilla in debate, except the format was kind of unusual. It was more like the NBA than what we're used to. Tell us about this challenging playoff system.
I wish I had been there to see it, honestly. it was a sort of a two-round tournament. Governor Parnell couldn't make the first round and therefore was disqualified. Eight candidates made it, and there was a scoring system. This was put on by the Palmer and Wasilla Chambers of Commerce. And they're going to do some more debates as well, and I'm not sure that they're going to try this tournament style again. But eight showed up. Parnell wasn't one of them. They had three judges, and they scored each candidate based on how well they did.
Was Dick Clark one of the judges?
I wish. The winners ended up being Ralph Samuels, Bill Walker, Ethan Berkowitz, and Hollis French. Well, Ralph Samuels had never committed to make the date for the next debate. So he was disqualified, and they moved Bob Poe into there because Sean Parnell obviously hadn't been there. So the next four would have been the three gubernatorial candidates and Bill Walker. Well, since then, Bob Poe has dropped out. So now they're down to three, and to sort of make it fair, I guess, the only ones that were going to participate, and I believe this may have happened last night, I'm not sure, but but it was going to be Bill Walker and Ethan Berkowitz. So they tried the bracket system, and it didn't work out so well. Maybe they should go to the BCS system instead of the bracket.
Have the AP vote?
Yeah.
That would be the way to do it. Paul, here's something from the campaign season. Clean Initiative Alaska wants to clean up Alaska politics. Clean Team Alaska. But they're not campaigning. In fact, they've suspended the campaign, and they've been very elusive, I think, about why. What is this all about?
Government's corrupt. That's what it's about. You betcha. This group got together. It's bashful about telling us who's funding this effort. They had an initiative drive to put ballot measure one on the ballot in the primary election. What it would do is pretty much...
The initiative.
Yeah, the initiative, the ballot question. And it'll still be on the ballot, I understand. What it does is it basically wipes out lobbying, campaign contributions from anybody holding a state contract. If you hold a state contract, you're done. You can't give
campaign. And cities couldn't hire lobbyists.
Cities couldn't lobby. Virtually the Alaska Municipal League and labor unions. And name a group that's not against this. I defy it. Everybody's
against it. Well, it expands to the families, too. Your niece.
Goes to their family.
Your niece, your sister-in-law, none of them can make political contributions.
Anybody in your family is out as well. I mean, it's unconstitutional on its face. And they admit that and say, well, yeah, some of it might be, but we'll just get rid of that part and keep the other part. Well, if you won't tell us where your money's coming from, and this thing is so poorly written as to just be a morass, I'm not sure... Why? Well, they complained. Well, the lieutenant governor changed the wording on the ballot question.
The summary.
That's right. The summary, and he made it worse for us, and we don't have a chance. Are you going to appeal? No, government's corrupt. We're not going to do that. We wouldn't have a chance. So here we are. They've suspended their campaign for whatever it was, and the ballot question remains on the ballot. And voters go to the poll and look at this and go, what?
Okay, Brendan, the view from the Anchorage Press.
Well, actually, since my last article about it came out, some further information's been revealed by the Newsminer up in Fairbanks that a big reason for the suspension of their campaign is the Alaska Public Offices Commission was pressing them to admit where their money was coming from. These initiatives, similar ones, have appeared, I believe we're the fifth state, and the articles that I've read and something that Dick Randolph, who was the chair of Clean Team Alaska back in it, said, a New York millionaire billionaire named Howie Rich is behind this. He said that a couple years ago when they were trying to get it on the 08 ballot. So it's been mysteriously funded by this organization called Alaskans for Open Government. They refused to say where their funding's coming from. And just recently, APOC said, no, I think that you really need to tell us where this money's coming from. And that's when they suspended the campaign.
Paul.
And the reason that they put the pressure on them, I think, the law used to be that you didn't have to disclose who was behind these initiatives until it was certified. Well, the law was rewritten to say, no, you have to disclose when you file. And so I think, and that was on Governor Parnell's desk. I don't know if he signed it yet or not, but it's waiting in the wings. I suspect he did.
Representative Johansson's bill, yeah.
I suspect
and
he did.
Does anybody know what the effective date on that legislation is?
I don't know.
Governor's got to sign it before we know, I think.
Okay. All right, Brendan, let's go back to you. The press has been looking at some important juvenile justice issues here in Alaska, and particularly the case of Keene Smith. What did the press find in this quite important case?
Well, there's a couple elements to the Smith case, Keene. Keene Smith was a 16-year-old and was out with two of his buddies. One was 16, another was 14. He was carrying a .38 special. They got into a rumble with another kid on the street. Keene handed off the gun to the other 16-year-old. The other 16-year-old shot the other kid they met on the street in the chest. So Keene gets charged with aggravated assault. First issue in this case is he was 16. It's mandatory in Alaska if you commit certain crimes at the age of 16, you will be tried as an adult. But Department of Corrections policy is you can't be kept with the adult population. They're not really separate facilities, so what that means is you go to administrative segregation, aka solitary, basically. So this kid, Keene Smith, spent more than 500 days in administrative segregation at the Anchorage Correctional Facility.
But do I understand you correctly, for no other reason than they didn't have a place to put him?
Yes. And the Department of Corrections is actually working on that. Carmen Gutierrez is the special assistant to Commissioner Schmidt of DOC. And they're working now. They've got this, it's called YOP. I can't think of what the acronym stands for. Youth Offender Program down at the Spring Creek facility in Seward. And right now they're working on making sure that the pretrial, these are people that are accused of a crime but not convicted of them, 16, 17-year-olds. They're trying to make sure that they get moved down to Spring Creek to the Youth Offender Program rather than sitting in administrative segregation here. Although when my colleague Scott Christensen reported on this, there were 3 juveniles in the administrative segregation here at the Anchorage Correctional Facility. The other thing they're trying to do in the Smith case, because he did plead guilty, the minimum under Alaska's standards, it's not mandatory minimums, but Alaska's minimums, is 7 years. That's been sent back to the judge because they want to use non-statutory mitigation is the terminology, but to say that he was 16 years old, there's ample scientific evidence that teenagers' brains don't understand cause and effect as well as an adult's brain does, so perhaps a different standard could be applied. The judge in his case will decide if this is true and refer it to a 3-judge panel.
Now, was he sentenced?
He was sentenced to the minimum, 7 years with 3 years suspended, I believe. But that has been successfully brought back to the same judge who's looking at it and may well send it to this 3-judge panel that could give him a lower than the minimum, lower than 7 years sentence.
Okay, let's get back to Paul Jenkins. Paul, bears and bicyclists cross paths again, and the outcome is not a happy one, at least for the human end of this. Tell us about this story and the response of the Department of Fish and Game and the mayor of Anchorage, because it happened here within the city limits.
Earlier this week, a gentleman at 5:30 in the morning on his bicycle was biking to work through Far North Bicentennial Park along Rover's Run, a trail where there have been, last year, there were 2 bear attacks, one left leaving a young teenage bicyclist pretty well mauled. This gentleman came around a turn, came up on a sow with a cub. The sow did what bears do and protected her cub. He played dead, she left. And that's when the real fun started, I suppose. We now have Fish and Game, where there's this outcry, of course, in the public, oh my God, a bear attack.
This is a policy question.
This is a policy question. And the policy of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is, well, what we need to do is close that trail down. What the city says, what Mayor Dan Sullivan says, is no, we don't close down facilities where there's a danger, because you're supposed to use your common sense and that sort of thing. Barb Fish and Game also, and he questions, and I think rightfully so, if we've got a bear problem, why are they in fact trying to expand, if you will, the salmon runs in these streams? So,
Paul,
I don't think anybody...
I'm waiting for you to say coddling bears.
No, we're not coddling bears. I don't get me wrong. I got nothing against bears. Whack them and stack them, and that's it. Then beyond that, no, I don't believe that at all. There's too many of them. We can't get rid of all of them. And we got to learn to be smarter about how we deal with them. But other than that, and I think Mayor Dan Sullivan's decision not to close that trail in the face of a state suggestion that A, it's unsafe, and B, it's the right thing to do. I don't know what that does as far as city liability down the road if there's another problem. Politically, it's a time bomb. So I don't know. What the outcome of all this will be. I guess we're all going to pray for winter and nobody else gets hurt.
Okay. Brendan, I wanted to get an update on the labor situation at the Sheraton Hotel and what the NRLB had to say about that longstanding labor dispute that has gone on for quite a long time now.
Yeah, it's been going on quite a while. The Hotel Workers Union, this is the people who clean the rooms, the people in the kitchen, the lower paid workers. The labor union's called Unite Here Local 878. They've put the hotel under boycott back in, I believe, November. They haven't been able to reach a collective bargaining agreement. A big part of this stems from the fact that the Sheraton was sold to an outside company based in Houston or Dallas, I forget
Remington,
which.
Remington, is it?
Remington is the management company. Ashland is the owner. They're actually the same company, 2 different divisions. But they haven't been able to come to a decision. They've each filed complaints against one another to the National Labor Relations Board and to the regional National Labor Relations Board. The regional NLRB came back with charges saying in 14 counts you've broken the law against Remington, including firing four workers, including intimidation, disparaging the union. And they suggested some remedies, give these people their jobs back, expunge their records, give them back pay. But that's not the end of it whatsoever. There is a hearing scheduled for August 10th at which this nationally known union busting attorney, Arch Stokes, who Remington has hired, will be representing them. And they can appeal this
thing. Aren't we supposed to call him someone who represents employer interests?
That's what he calls himself, I believe. I talked to him, and they can take this thing all the way up to the Supreme Court. So this is just step one.
And by that definition, we have no idea how long it might take to play itself out. Okay, we do know how long it's taken to play out Anchorage Edition. We're out of time. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.